there and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb and today I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco, back from
Chicago.
From Chicago, back from podcast No Land. And we are in the Large Catechism. You joined us for the last two episodes of the show.
Yeah.
On episode 3.
Brings back memories of good days in Southern California.
By the beach, the weather's perfect.
Yeah, let's stop talking about that.
You're so mean. Yeah, just a little bit. Last episode, we did the third and fourth commandment. We're in the fifth commandment now, which Luther identifies as a bit of a transition, which is interesting. And we will just jump right in. For those curious who two of our translations have the paragraph number, so we'd be using the, I think if you have the reader's edition of the Book of Concord, I believe they keep the line numbers in there as well. Some of the older ones do. I know that certain standalone large catechisms don't, though. So if you have one of those, it would be hard to follow those. But okay. So as it's in mine, thou shalt not kill. We have now completed both the spiritual and the temporal government, that is the divine and paternal authority and obedience. So he's marking a transition here to, but here now we go forth from our house among our neighbors to learn how we should live with one another, everyone himself towards his neighbor. And then actually sort of goes to describe like that there is an authority to kill. But just about who that belongs to is really where this commandment lines up. So it says,
and in what way?
It's and not in what just way?
Kill yeah. for the sake of
killing, right?
Yeah. It's probably better translated, "Thou shalt not murder."
Right.
But
I always thought it was interesting that most of them don't translate it that way.
I know it is.
I always thought that because he even says right off the bat, he says, "God and government are not included in this commandment." Nor is the power to kill taken away from them. And maybe he's just making the distinction that if it's not sort of a sanctioned killing, it is murder.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the assumption here.
Yeah.
That I think probably everybody just, translators probably assume that the audience knows by kill we're talking about murder.
Yeah.
I would, maybe in an older time, but
yeah, and
today.
Pre-pacifistic eras.
Oh, and I mean, there's just a very large movement against even the government's authority to kill, both in military action and in domestic issues as far as things
sure.
like the death penalty
sure.
are concerned. That's a very substantial movement today.
Mm-hmm. You know what Luther says of pacifists? He calls them immoral.
Yeah.
If they're not willing to defend their neighbor.
Yeah.
Oh.
And that has to do with defense of neighbor specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's. I mean, when I've talked to pacifists, that's usually the thing that
they
comes
think
up. That is,
they have the moral high ground.
Well, no, I would say the thing that comes up is, what do you do if somebody is attacking your children or harming your children, or your wife? Don't you have a duty to protect your children and your wife? Maybe the broader neighbor is a harder justification, but at least in that case, and I think it presents a challenge for a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, so then. Yeah, therefore God and government are not included in this commandment, nor is the power to kill, which they have taken away. For God has delegated his authority to punish evildoers to the government instead of parents, who for a time, as was read in Moses, were required to bring their own children to judgment and sentence them to death.
Jeez.
Oof. Therefore, what
have you
is
ever it? Felt that way?
I mean, I felt
that. Have you ever been thankful that we don't live under the Mosaic law?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I've been thankful. Yeah. Where did I leave off? Therefore, what is here forbidden is forbidden to the individual in his relation to anyone else and not to the government. I mean, this is basically saying you don't get to be somebody's final judge,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't get to determine yeah. that a crime or that an offense against you is so great that it demands somebody's life without the mediation of an authority like government.
Yeah.
Yeah, but pretty quickly, he does the Jesus, what I'll call the Jesus move on this, and he explains, as Christ sums this up, that we're not to kill neither with hand, okay, that one's the actual physical killing, nor with heart, nor with mouth, nor with sign, nor with gesture, nor with help, So you can't contract a murder, sorry. nor with counsel, right? You can't, like, counsel somebody that maybe they, as David did, that maybe they should do something that will result in the death of
your
enemy.
That's right.
But he covers the whole swath there. I mean, there's, and then later on links this to the idea that even anger and reproof, so maybe think like extreme anger that results in consequences for somebody else in some way are the, and punishment are the prerogatives of God and his representatives. So God probably in the state, I think you'd be talking about here.
And then he talks about parents lower down as well.
Yeah. And that what God wishes in this commandment is to remove the root and the source of the bitterness towards your neighbor that would cause you to murder.
To murder them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting because we rarely even talk about it that way sort of societally. This is mostly a murdering is mostly spoken of and just, you know, did somebody physically die? I think there's implications for this expanded, which is like Christ's original expanded definition and how Luther does it here in our day with just how often people are sort of, their worlds are attacked publicly online, mm-hmm. you know, because somebody is angry or disagrees or whatever and tries to destroy them.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of our public discourse today is wrapped up in the destruction of the disagreeing party or the other party.
Yeah.
Right? It will only be satisfying once they're gone.
Yeah. They don't exist anymore.
Right.
I think that's called cancel culture.
Cancel culture. And you would know, Caleb, doxing? Is that where you out somebody online for being a racist or whatever?
Doxing is like, in the strictest sense, is like if somebody's anonymous online, you post information about them that would give you who it is. Or if somebody's not anonymous, they just have their name, you could dox somebody that you're angry with by, say, finding their address, right?
And alerting their employer and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Or trying to get people to harm them. You know, say a journalist publishes something you don't like, you go, this is where they sleep at night. You do something about it, and that would certainly fall into this, right? Because you're publicly trying to avoid "quote unquote" threatening them by doing this. You're not saying I'm going to harm you, but you're putting out whatever's necessary
by counsel.
Yep, but for other people to do it, sort of implying that if you wanted to harm this person, here's where you could find them.
Luther says just after that he wants us to keep his commandment before our eyes as if it were a mirror, in order to learn to calm our anger and to be patient and have a gentle heart, then throw a little comma in there, especially towards our enemies. Boy, is that the absolute opposite of the way that things happen. I mean, just obviously in his time too, but it's so easy to see this happen online. It's so easy to see this happen the other way on social media now. Right. That it's so infrequent that somebody would keep an admonishment not to murder and having that applying that to your heart and your words and your signs and your gestures so much that you keep it before your eyes as if a mirror, so that you allow your anger to calm rather than just hop on your phone and react to it, you know. Yeah. And that you learn to be patient, have a gentle heart, especially towards your enemies.
Yeah, well, it's actually information like this, endless information, is the opposite of a mirror looking back at yourself. You can avoid yourself and look into other people's souls and minds.
Your Facebook feed doesn't show you just pictures of yourself. It shows you pictures of everybody else and things everybody else did.
I mean, he talks about how, you know, this commandment is needed because God plainly knows that that this life is full of turmoil and unhappiness. And that unhappy people turn into angry people turned against each other. I mean, this one's, I don't know, this one's quite condemning for me. I know that over the last year especially, I have been extraordinarily angry and wanted to see the destruction of people who I felt were like, had a different opinion than me on a very, very wide band of topics.
It's easy to get to that point where we're just bombarded with people's opinions, and it's wedded to politics and power. You know, it's easy to, like we, you know, I critique the left all the time and their sort of tribalism. They lump people in these categories or classes and defined by race and so on and so forth. And it's so easy to hate that and hate the people who are behind that, especially because it's just all ever present. But if you're attending to your family and doing fulfilling your obligations in your home, it's actually, it's not easy, but that stuff can fade away, you know. But yes, getting online, look, scrolling through the gram.
Oh, that's what I've
or probably Twitter.
Seen as a solution to this as well is as I have become, you know, especially if you feel like your back is up against a wall politically for whatever reasons, right? You feel like there's going to be an imposition on you and your family and things. It turns out that if you actually stop thinking about the ethereal out there, downward pressure against you and all this oppression that's going to come because it's out there and you just start doing things with your family and
or your neighborhood, you'll find that it's really easy to, as Luther put it in the Bonds of the Will, to universalize a particular.
Yeah.
It's very easy to assume that because your neighbor maybe has a bumper sticker that identifies them with some political party or something like that, that they're like the monsters you see on Instagram or whatever. Yeah. And chances are, you just talk to them.
Yeah.
They're probably just, with air quotes, you know, a decent or a good person.
Well, you could even say chances are that the monsters on Instagram, if you were to meet them, aren't truly monsters.
Right, yeah.
You know, in the same way you thought that we have this tendency to create an online persona that's really an online persona that's not the same as the person that we are in our daily, and that's sometimes to make us look better, that's sometimes to make us look more aggressive, sometimes make us look more politically active than we actually are. All these, very easy to do this under the relative anonymity of an online persona. Harder with your neighbor who lives right next door.
Yeah,
not impossible.
And when it's harder. When it's eyeball to eyeball or flesh and blood and flesh and blood, it's a lot easier to be human and civil. Even though you might have radically different ideas.
Right.
Well, and that I think that's part of the thing is it makes the realm of ideas seem very real. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's what the sort of the distant discourse does. It makes it seem like somebody's political idea is a reality right now, right here, in your life, doing something to you, and it probably isn't. It's probably an idea for the most part. Yeah. And if you just, one of the quickest ways to cool down from that is to just leave the realm of ideas and go spend time with your family and your friends.
Maybe go lift some weights.
Paragraph 189 is interesting because it gets, I don't remember if it was before the show or at the beginning of the show, but Adam was talking about
That was during the show about pacifism.
Yeah, pacifism. 189, secondly, under this commandment, not only he is guilty who does evil to his neighbor, but he also who can do him good, prevent, resist evil, defend and save him so that no bodily harm or hurt happened to him and yet does not do it. He goes on in the next one to give some examples of that. Includes clothing people, feeding people, standing up for the innocent who are being wrongly accused. If you have the power to stand up for them, and you don't, so that's not, that one's not going to apply to everybody, right? But if you are, if you're in a position of power and you know that somebody who is innocent, that the full force of the government is coming against somebody who's innocent, and you don't do something to stand in the way, that's sinning against this commandment.
This is a tough one with the, like here in Southern California or where I live in Chicago with homeless people everywhere.
Yeah, it's
difficult. And knowing on one hand that if you give them some cash, it's probably going to go to drugs. That's the assumption. That might be a bad assumption.
I think it becomes a reasonable assumption over time, though.
Yeah, yeah. But then, and then if you got $10 in your pocket that you're probably going to spend on a Slurpee and a Slim Jim or whatever.
I haven't had those in good
20 years, but that's bad for you anyway. Why not maybe buy a burger and fries for that person? You know, I struggle with it. Every time when I get off to go to work, there's homeless people cruising up and down the lanes of traffic, and I don't carry cash, but for a while I was giving them MREs. I had a whole bunch of old MREs, and I was like, here's some you know, 6,000 calories, it'll probably stop you up for 2 weeks. But
the U.S. government said it's safe. Don't worry.
But it's tough, and I'm probably guilty of sinning a lot when it comes to that.
It is tough. It's a in California, it's an overwhelming circumstance. Like, yeah, I even coming through. This is an affluent town, San Clemente. But if you walked, you know, what's the reasonable length to go on a walk with your dog in the morning? Maybe 2 or 3 miles. If you walked to that distance here in San Clemente, you would pass by
hundreds.
Well, I don't know about on this main
depends
street.
On which way you go.
Yeah, probably 30 though that you could give those $10 to. Mm-hmm. And so it's
how do you pick?
I think the reality that he's talking about here is
somebody comes knocking on your door.
A little less debate in a little less debatable circumstance. And I'm not even saying those are debatable, but obviously the problem that we have with homelessness and
California/America
is complex. Is complex.
It's also
very different from this context too.
It's a good reminder of Jesus, the poor you will always have with you, right? Yeah. You can do something good maybe for somebody who needs it. Yeah. But you're not going to eliminate poverty by clothing somebody you see who's cold and sick. It's great, and it's a good work, but you're not actually ending world hunger or poverty or homelessness when you do that.
No, but I think the point is if you have the obvious chance to help somebody who's genuinely in need, and you for the sake of callousness pass it up.
Yeah.
When you could have fairly easily done something to help, that falls into this commandment. And I think, to be clear, we're all going to sin against this commandment, more broadly defined as Christ and Luther define it here, every day. And the only answer is to flee to Christ for refuge and forgiveness of sins. But I think it's helpful to think about this, because this is one of those commandments that if you just think about it in terms of don't kill somebody, you're like, I got that one locked in. You know, you can do the same thing. We're going to do the sixth commandment. Don't commit adultery. Well, say you've been married for 20 some odd years and you've never had an affair with a woman. You can be like, check, got that one. But you expand these definitions and you expand them out towards service to neighbor and honoring people and honoring their humanity, even when you think that they're not doing as good a job as you are in life. And it becomes a different thing to think about here.
Right. Line 193 and 194. Therefore, it is God's ultimate purpose that we suffer harm to befall no man, but show him all good in love. As we have said, it is especially directed towards those who are our enemies. For to do good to our friends is but an ordinary heathen virtue, as Christ says in Matthew 5:46.
Which is true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I mean, if you've ever... from life experience, I can tell you that even the heathens who are your close friends will stand by you in time of need.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, this isn't about fulfilling the basic obligations of loyalty to people that you already have some dependence or friendship with,
or quasi quid pro quo relationship with.
And so, you know, again, in sort of what this law is accusing in people is saying you cannot get outside of the thumb on the law on this by saying, well, I'm really good to my friends.
Right. Or my family.
Yeah.
I take care of me and mine.
Yeah. Right. And as long as I'm doing that, I'm serving God and country. Don't worry. Let's see here. Last paragraphs. This we ought to practice and inculcate, and we would have our hands full doing good works. But this would not be preaching for monks. It would be greatly detract from the religious estate and infringe upon the sanctity of the Carthusians.
Mm-hmm.
And would even be regarded as forbidding good works and clearing the convents. For in this wise and ordinary state, Christians would be considered just as worthy and even worthier. And everybody who would see how they mock and delude the world with a false hypocritical show of holiness, because they have given this and other commandments to the wind and have esteemed them unnecessary, as though they were not commandments but mere counsel, and have at the same time shamelessly proclaimed and boasted their hypocritical estate and works as their most perfect life, in order that they might lead a pleasant and easy life without the cross and without patience, for which reason, too, they have resorted to the cloister, so that they might not be obligated to suffer any wrong from anyone or do any good.
Yeah, Carthusians, these are medieval monks. I'm trying to remember the most famous one. I don't think it was Bernard of Clairvaux a Carthusian? I don't think he was. I know there's one named Denis the Carthusian who's pretty famous. He was
Denis the Carthusian,
15th century. And I mean they were in the Middle Ages, certainly at this by the high and late Middle Ages, monasticism was very institutionalized. You know, they live in cloistered communities. They
probably nicer than the communities around them.
In many cases. The Carthusians, however, emphasized a real ascetic life.
Yeah.
Not the same, obviously, but kind of comparable to if you've ever been to India or know a bit about India, there are different types of Hinduism. There's one called Jainism where they will just sit for as long as they can so they do not run the risk of stepping on a bug or something like that. Now, Carthusians aren't interested in that so much, but
the less you interact with the world, the less chance you have to sin, chance.
So they were pretty extreme. Luther did not like Dominicans. He did not like Franciscans. He really did not like Carthusians. Anyway, just a little historical.
Well, a little of his Augustinian one-sidedness coming out here.
I mean, I think what you see here is he identifies multiple ways in which people try to get out underneath the thumb of this one.
Sure.
Where he's just saying, I can avoid this one. I can even avoid it the way Jesus describes it by just not interacting with people.
Yeah.
That's you know, it's easy not to murder people if I don't see anybody.
If I go live in a cave.
Yeah. And so... And then
the point is that you're sort of missing your calling too.
Well, and then how many people are you quote unquote murdering by not being there?
Yeah.
And that's, that's an interesting one. And so I there's a theme here that's recurring, which is he's not going to give an inch on some of the typical outs that people would be familiar with.
Well, he never misses a chance to go after the monks. Yeah.
He's got a little baggage.
Once he gave it up, he's like, "Yeah, this is not good."
Yeah. All right. We should go to the sixth commandment. Sixth commandment: Thou shalt not commit adultery. These commandments now that follow are easily understood from the explanation of the preceding, for they are all to the effect that we be careful to avoid doing any kind of injury or harm to our neighbor. So I think that's an interesting point. So after the fourth, he talks about how things are now outward looking from sort of the you and yours, the family, and God. And now all of these boil down to a very similar rule, which Jesus boils down to two rules, right? Love God and love your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah, he's pretty clear here too at the beginning of this. That if you commit adultery, you're sinning against the person that you've committed to be of one flesh with. And that the admonition here is not just a sexual admonition, but it's not just merely a sexual admonition. Because he gets into several times in here... that is forbidden here to bring any disgrace upon. He'll use sort of this way, bring any disgrace upon yourself with respect to your wife. But what he's saying, I think, more generally is to bring any disgrace upon yourself with respect to your spouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
to dishonor them in such a way that you're actually dishonoring your own body.
Right, and then just the amount of, I mean, he's just pretty blatant about the amount of harm it does too, that if you take somebody else's wife, you can do almost no greater harm to somebody, that this is their the greatest possession, quote unquote, would be to take.
Well, think about it, and beyond the sin and the shame of the physical sin that you inflict on yourself and somebody else because you took their wife, right? If you think about when we first talked about the fourth commandment, Adam explained the three estates to us, this is the one that would be potentially most harmful to that first estate. to that state of family. This has the potential to destroy your family, to destroy the family of the person that you're cheating with, and for generations beyond that, destroy those kids' view of that estate in general, and whether or not it can be trusted, whether or not it is a primary estate, whether or not it's a useful estate. And so this, there's a big admonition here, and it, that admonition has to do with the, if that first estate is the primary one, and if the other, you know, the civil estate, the governmental estate comes out of that too, and order is kept in society through that, if you destroy this estate through something like adultery, you're potentially doing a lot of harm just beyond you and yours.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, fatherlessness in America.
Yeah. It's...
People talk about it, but nobody wants to talk about it.
There's billboards through the Inland Empire now. As I was driving down here from Big Bear this weekend, I saw two billboards about like father involvement, and it was like CaliforniaFatherhood.org, like get resources and things like that. Because
sociologists, psychologists all say that one of the biggest predictors of a child's success, however that might be defined, their civility and all
their
the
success
rest
in school, their career
is,
place,
was there a father in the
graduate
home?
I mean, all of it was there a father in the home? Lower instances of early sexual activity, drug use, runaways, I mean, you name it.
It's the linchpin.
Yeah.
So as we move forward here, I think this is interesting because Luther thinks like public displays of lewdity are really bad in his time, and I think he would be pretty shocked now. So he says, this commandment really aims at adultery because amongst the Jews, it was ordained and commanded that one must be married. Therefore, also the young were early provided into marriage so that the virgin estate was held in small esteem. Neither were public prostitution and lewdness tolerated as they are now. Therefore, adultery was the common form of unchastity among them. But because among us there is a shameful mess and the very dregs and all vices and lewdness, this commandment is also directed against every manner of unchastity, whatever it may be called. We probably call that OnlyFans today. Public prostitution in Luther's time.
Oh, I didn't know what you're talking about.
You guys don't know what?
No.
No, you guys are out of the times. You can sell yourself online for very cheap nowadays. It's very common.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's it called?
OnlyFans. You guys haven't heard of this?
I've never heard of this.
No.
It's basically...
We're like dinosaurs.
I guess you wouldn't be alone. People can pay a subscription fee like they would to Netflix or something to watch you on a cam or get pictures of you naked.
Why would they want pictures of me naked?
Not you naked.
Really good question.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, it's the newest form of public prostitution.
Oh, okay.
And it's because it's online, it's completely unregulated, and you just can do it free market kind of.
Yeah. It's like paid Instagram, but with nudes.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
I was going to say, what's it cost? But I thought that'd be a little.
No, let's. We should
I'm just kidding. I'm just.
I think it's a. That he says this applies to every form of unchastity. Just let your mind run wild with that. But not only are external acts forbidden, but also every kind of cause. So what causes you to move into this externally forbidden act? And then he goes, and every kind of motive and every kind of means. In other words, what are you doing that's leading you down the path that all of a sudden you find yourself in some sort of external and forbidden act. So not only is that forbidden, but these others are forbidden because the end result is inevitably going to be that you are going to become unfaithful. Even if you don't consider your sort of emotional relationship with somebody unfaithful, even if you don't consider sort of your flirting unfaithful, even if you don't consider you're watching your pornography unfaithful or whatever, the end result is likely going to be unfaithfulness. And so not only is that external act forbidden, but everything that's going to lead up to that is forbidden because it's going to lead you down the path. Likely it's going to lead you down the path where, again, you make an outward visible attack on this first estate.
Right. Yeah. Well, and then, it continues to go to say that this is a confirmation of like the commandment and the blessing of matrimony, that it you know, that this matrimony comes before the sanctioned estate of the father and the mother, and comes before the fourth commandment in this way, that without a proper relationship between husband and wife and the joining of people in marriage.
Well, note how highly God honors and glorifies married life, significantly that he established it as the first of all institutions. I think this is interesting because we said it in the thou shalt not murder. This commandment, everyone is required to live chastely himself / and to help his neighbor do the same. So there's an admonishment here, not only to lead a chaste life yourself, but that if you see your neighbor heading down this path, to try to defend his marriage too.
Right. Yeah, not just gossip about it and say, you see what's happening over there. Yeah.
Not just to stand idly by and let this first estate of your neighbor's marriage and family be destroyed too.
Yeah, this can be a hard one. I mean, with high divorce rates, or if you're my age, lots of people in long-term relationships then break up and then get another one and then break up and get another one. You kind of watch this happen all the time. All right.
I don't have the paragraph numbers here, but he talks about, he goes, in the second place, you must know also that it is not only an honorable but also a necessary state, and it is solemnly commanded by God that in general, in all conditions, men and women who are created for it shall be found in this estate of marriage, though there are some exceptions, whom God has especially accepted so that they are not fit for the married estate, or whom has released by a high supernatural gift that they can maintain chastity without this estate.
Supernatural.
And, yeah. I mean, yeah. And that's the way Paul talks about it.
That's absolutely the way he talks about it.
And then, but then he goes on and says, and this is Luther being very Lutheran, gritty, I guess, or calling a thing what it is, right? For where nature has its course, as it is implanted by God, it is not possible to remain chaste without marriage.
Right.
And he goes on.
Where nature has its course. Yeah.
I think that's a good argument. I don't want to get too much on this as one of my hobby horses, but it's a good argument for rethinking the way we've societally told
delaying
young
marriage.
Adults to wait to get married. And it's funny, in the church, you sort of, like in a conservative church, like we're all in, is you have this twofold message. It's like, well, don't get married until you've graduated high school, graduated college, maybe even graduated
your
master's
program. Stable.
And you're financially stable, which means you're probably going to be pushing 30 by the time you get married. And don't fornicate. It's like, okay, so these people become, you know, sexually aware, you know, or of age, quote unquote.
They're in the prime of their lives.
You know, even if it's late, let's say 15, and then they're supposed to wait another decade to decade and a half before they act on it at all, as we tell them not to get married.
I think one of the things that's an accident is I don't know if it just occurred younger, but I think some of that advice about like financially stable or in a career and things like that happened younger, just even 50 years ago. And so there's, when they say that, they probably still have a 24-year-old in their in their mind. Well, today that's just not the case.
He points out here, when he's talking about among the Jews, the youth were married at the earliest possible age.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's a reason. I'm not saying we go back to like marrying off 13-year-olds, but maybe there's a reason to think about this as being an honorable estate, even within young adults, than sort of.
It is certainly, you know, career or personal success is significantly more important, I think, for most people than this, especially when you're, you know, between 18 and 25. It is about getting that settled first. What's interesting is that if you actually end up in the estate of marriage, that personal success is actually sort of already at a loss. You're having to give up part of yourself or your entire self to somebody else at the same time. And so,
at the same time, like to bring in sociology or psychology, another predictor of success is those who do get married. You know, there's more incentive to be
financial
successful.
Success, yeah, especially, yeah. It's interesting. 2:17, he says, one of the reasons he makes this entire argument in this section is, I speak of this in order that the young may be so guided that they conceive a liking for the marriage state.
Yeah.
Boy, is that
different. And know that it is a blessed estate.
And know that it's a blessed estate. Boy, is that different from the way we try to think about it now. That the young people might conceive a liking for the marriage state.
Yeah, that they want to be married.
That they want to be married.
And maybe even have children.
And maybe even have children.
Yeah.
Lots of them, Caleb. How many do you have? Two?
Two. Yeah.
Maybe five.
Maybe five, maybe six.
No. Well, he's got
aim for the moon.
I think he's got the car now that can handle four.
So. I can have four. I cap out at a certain...
or Keith. It's still kind of about the car.
It's still kind of about the car. But,
well, I mean, that's a thing. You know, the bigger family you have, the more the bigger the car you got to get, and the more...
What am I supposed to get? A passenger van after?
Yeah, the Nissan NU...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
530 or whatever it is.
NV.
NV. Sorry.
Oh, my Lord.
It's not about the car for me.
We know.
I'm too cheap.
You're getting the passenger van? There's nothing wrong with a good passenger van, actually.
No.
I hope that's actually one of the ones that would be acceptable to me if I had to bump up.
It's one of the ones your father wouldn't make fun of you for.
Especially one of the ones you can get in 4x4.
Luther says this quite a bit. It's I don't know where else I read it, where he talks about how he critiques how men complain about their wives and, you know, like, I've been married for 20 years, but it feels like an eternity, and, you know, say things like that. And he says, think about what little ears pick up when you're talking like that, and warns against it. Even though you might dislike each other for that moment, it's important to honor.
Only do that at coffee with your buddies.
Right.
Not around your children. Yeah. Yeah.
But on this, when he talks about people... The young might like married estate. He goes on. He's pretty outright about what I just said. He said that there might be less of the filthy, dissolute, disorderly doings which now run riot the world over in open prostitution and other shameful vices arising from the disregard of married life. So this is a sort of nothing's new under the sun except for sort of the mode and manner might be a little bit easier now than it was then.
Can you believe that sexually mature adults engage in sexual activities? You're like, yes. that's Luther's point too. It's people are going to engage in these. And there's actually an estate under which that becomes beneficial, fruitful, for the good of both them and their neighbor, and then there's everything else.
Yeah, and this wouldn't have been very common to the people of his time. I mean, within Catholicism, you either sort of got married or took holy orders. This was part of the sacramental system.
And
there wasn't really an in-between option.
Yeah, I don't know what century it was, but sometime in the middle of the Middle Ages, I've seen estimates that say a fifth of Europe's population, which was relatively small at that time, but still a fifth of the population at least had taken holy orders.
Yeah. Wow.
And by Luther's time, it's probably not that many, but, this is one of the reasons why he rails against the monastic estate, because it really, in addition to just the bad theology and so on, it wrecks civilization, takes people out of the world, reinforces that sort of narcissism, that sort of turned inwardness and focusing on your own life and not on serving your neighbor.
And people, it's funny, it takes people out of the world who probably have good intentions.
The commands of God in mind
and things like that.
To be sure, but he called the monastic estate, the Munkstande, the fourth estate, an estate of the devil.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it makes, like, I guess what I was trying to say is that, like, these are people who, had they had the commands of God in mind while they were still living in society, could actually benefit society to the ends explained here in the Large Catechism.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth noting, as you get towards the end of this, you get it very clearly in the Small Catechism. But for Luther, this is not only about not sinning in thought, word, and deed. In this estate, but he says essentially the same line that he says in the Small Catechism, but that everyone love and esteem the spouse given to them by God.
Mm-hmm.
This is also about loving and esteeming and caring for not just going through the motions of the command, but actually cherishing the one that God has given you.
Yeah. And he concludes with these wonderful words. Here you have again a precious, yes, many and great good works of which you can joyfully boast against all ecclesiastical estates. It's holier than the priesthood, perhaps, chosen without God's word and commandment.
Yeah.
So what is ordained by God is marriage. What is not is these monastic ecclesiastical orders that would prohibit you or forbid you from from marriage.
Well, great, guys. Made it to time. It was great having you back, Adam. Maybe you'll
good to be back.
Have to fly out to California more.
That would be awesome.
And
but the problem is when I'm here, I'm not committing adultery, but I'm like, I want to stay here, even though my wife's over there. It's so warm and beautiful.
You're lusting after the beach.
Oh, just the air smells wonderful. When you're not walking by homeless people.
Well, guys, hey, thank you for joining us on this episode. We have been walking through the Lutheran Confessions, and if you've been joining us for the last 8 weeks, we really appreciate it. We hope that this is remaining an encouragement to explore and read these with your family yourself. And so, again, thank you for joining us on this episode. We will catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.